From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, the occult. Here's what's happening. The Pentagon is preparing to withdraw thousands of troops from Afghanistan as part of a proposed peace deal with the Taliban. They're the ones we tossed out of Afghanistan 18 years ago. One official warned that the withdrawal would be subject to the completion of any agreement. So far, no such deal has been finalized. We went into Afghanistan October 2001, 18 years ago after 9/11. The agreement would require the Taliban to broker a peace deal directly with the Afghan government and give assurances that the country won't be used as a launch pad for international terror attacks. However, some officials have concerns about how to hold the group accountable. The Washington Post reported that if finalized, the agreement would cut the number of troops in the country from 14,000 to between 8,000 and 9,000 soldiers. Federal law enforcement based on the U.S.-Mexico border are expected to encounter 1.1 million people trying to cross illegally by the end of the fiscal year, September 30th, despite Mexico's assistance stopping migrants on their journey north. They all want to get into the United States. Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com with us. John, it's a mess. I mean, I can understand how these people want a better life, but what are we going to do to control it?
Well, I mean, I don't think there's anything you can do other than build more fencing. I mean, the truth is that, you know, the Marshall Plan in World War II was a massive expenditure of GDP. We all know that the economy is not, you know, I mean, kind of teetering at the moment. The Federal Reserve Board just cut the interest federal funds rate, indicating that the economy is weak right now. And, you know, I don't know if you heard that report that the federal budget deficit is now exceeding $1 trillion. And they've just signed a continuing, Congress just approved, and Trump is supposed to sign a new CBR, which is going to increase the national debt by another $2 trillion. So the idea, George, that the U.S. is going to fund some massive Marshall Plan that's going to, you know, place industry and businesses and cash into these economies in these failed states of Central America, especially Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala, where most of these immigrants are coming from, it's just not going to happen. And even if it were to happen, it would take years, if not decades, assuming that that money would be spent as it's indicated, where there's no indication that that would happen at all. So I think what you have is there's no immigration reform package that Congress can enact, short of basically opening the borders up to just anybody, that would satisfy the Democrat Party right now. And I think that immigration, unfortunately, you know, that 1.1 million number is just staggering by, September 30th. And this has simply become a political issue in this election year right now.
All right, John, thank you so much. John Curtis, track him on onlinecolumnist.com. Well, the curse on the Kennedy family continues. The 22-year-old granddaughter of the late Robert F. Kennedy has died tonight at the political family's compound in Hyannisport, Massachusetts, reportedly of a drug overdose. Sad story there for the family. Amazon founder Jeff Bezos sold shares worth $1.8 billion in the last 3 days of July, reducing the value of his stake in the world's third most valuable company now to about $110 billion. Coast to Coast guest demonologist Craig S. Martin is dead. He died at the age of 62. We don't have a lot of information yet. He was an expert on the occult. Craig Martin dead at the age of 62. 70-year-old boy in India has been relieved of year-long swelling and pain in his jaw after doctors removed a growth that had been harboring over 500 teeth inside of him. 500 teeth! The boy, identified as Randhavacheni, had been experiencing discomfort on the right side of his jaw since he was three, I would guess so. We've got that complete story and some video in our highlight reel at coasttocoastam.com. And another story in the highlight reel, an Australian crocodile farmer says the discovery of a human orthopedic plate inside the belly of a 1,500-pound crocodile may be the clue that leads authorities to the fate of a missing person. Peter Davenport with the National UFO Reporting Center with us with his weekly report. What's going on in the skies, Peter?
Well, good evening, George. It's been a banner month, the month of July, in terms of both quantity and quality of reports. We've gotten some doozies.
Perfect.
Really good reports. First one I'd like to kick off with tonight is one I briefly touched on last week. It comes from Benicia, California. The gentleman writes that he was outside looking at the nighttime sky, as he frequently does, with his very high-quality astronomical binoculars, 10 by 42s, and he saw a very faint object moving across the sky. It captured his attention because it was so erratic in its flight. Well, I'd hope to have his illustration of what it looked like on our website. Our webmaster has it, but hasn't posted it yet. The witness's illustration should be up there before too long, and probably by tomorrow.
All right, great.
Second report I'd like to touch on, I had hoped to present last week, but it comes from Charlotte, North Carolina. On the 19th of July, Friday that was, I believe, a gentleman was swimming in a pool, and he was looking up at the night sky. Suddenly he saw a very bright object that was so unusual in appearance that it captured his attention. Within a minute, he estimates there were seven more very similar in appearance. Within a few minutes more, he saw 10 more, and then 20, and then 20 again, and 20 still a third time. He estimates he saw 100 objects, each of which was bigger than a bright star, moving at random in a random fashion across the nighttime sky. More recently, the 23rd of July, a young mother and her 11-year-old daughter in Alden, New York, were outside, and they suddenly, like this guy I just described a moment ago, their attention was drawn to a strange light. It was a large red light, and it had two white lights circling around it. Have no idea what it was, but suddenly the white lights combined with the red light, and the red light just streaked off into the night sky. The next three reports are perhaps related. These come from two nights ago, Tuesday, the 30th of July. The Isle of Palms, which is due east of Charleston, South Carolina.
Yeah, pretty area.
Four people were on the beach, and they saw four yellow lights form a straight line in horizontal orientation. Suddenly, four more came down and lined up above the first four. The interesting part of this, George, is that they were apparently seen at the same time or a short time later from Folly Beach, which is southwest of Charleston. They're probably about 40 miles apart. If those two groups of people saw them at the same time, they must have been very high. And finally, final report comes from Missouri. 5 minutes after these two sightings near Charleston, two sisters were sitting outside in Climax Springs, Missouri. One got up to go inside, and she suddenly froze and said, "What's that?" Her sister looked over, and they saw five orange lights similar to what had been reported from the Charleston area. So those are just a flavor of the reports we have posted, and there will be more still in the next 24 hours, I anticipate. We'll get probably 170 more reports posted.
Mine, you don't stop, Peter. How about any events coming up for you?
I do indeed, George, and thanks for asking. August 10th, Saturday, I've been invited by Washington State Chapter of MUFON to join their monthly meeting over in Spokane, and be talking on a lot of the reports I present on coast to coast, and I'm going to be talking about the use of passive radar for detecting UFOs directly. September, I've been invited to speak at the Mile High Mystery Conference on the 20th, 21st, and 22nd of September. So I've got a busy month ahead of me, and hopefully people can come and join the celebration.
Well, you give everybody our best out there too, Peter. Thanks. Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Up next, Slaying the Sky Dragon, Death of the Greenhouse Gas Theory. Joseph Olson joins us next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Joseph Olson back with us. The latest work, Slaying the Sky Dragon, Death of the Greenhouse Gas Theory. Civil engineer for more than 30 years, Joseph worked with Dr. Tim Ball, one of our regular guests, and other scientists on an important science text debunking the greenhouse gas theory. We're going to be talking about our planet for the next couple hours on Coast to Coast. Joseph, welcome back. How are you, sir?
Oh, George, it's wonderful to have another edition of Insomnia Radio.
You got that right. So how are things with our temperatures these days?
Well, I was going to start with the general world news, kind of serendipity. This week, Congress labeled Antifa as a terrorist organization, and the FBI went, no, it's not Antifa. It's the conspiracy theorists who are the terrorists. And yeah, that's kind of odd. So we may actually one day get to meet at a FEMA re-education camp.
Well, you never know about that. So what have you been working on lately?
A whole bunch of different things. But I began my public speaking career when I was competing against Walt Disney for $1 billion rail project in Houston.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. And one of the politicians that I talked to said, oh, you're on the rubber chicken circuit? He said, let me give you a hint. He said, always begin your speech with a joke or a quote. And since there's not much to joke about, let's begin with a quote. The naked truth is always better than the best dressed lie by Ann Landers. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to get into a little bit of naked truth. So as mentioned, I had done an extensive amount of research, probably written over 100 articles on global warming and green energy and peak oil. And then a couple of years ago, I started investigating, actually a decade ago, I started investigating 911. And so the last 2 years, I've been spending a lot of time on 911 and some of the other conspiracy theories. You have a guy named Bart Sembrell that you've had on as a guest.
He's been on before. He's the one who wanted Buzz Aldrin to swear on the Bible that he went to the moon. And Buzz popped him one.
Well, and then Dr. James Fetzer, who I've had a really good relationship with for the last 2 years, did a book on the Apollo landings. And so I thought, well, you know, I don't want to wear every conspiracy hat in the house, but if this one fits, I find something that nobody else has mentioned, I'll go ahead and write about that. So we'll get to that in a little while, but let's switch back to the main subject. Since we're having these 20 candidates debating how much global warming there is, it's time for us to put that little puppy to rest. Okay, first of all, let's start with the history of it. They claim that the greenhouse gas theory was first proposed by Fourier in 1824, and that's completely invalid.
We didn't have cars then, did we?
Well, we didn't have a periodic table. We didn't have a model of the atom. We didn't have laws of thermodynamics. We didn't understand electromagnetic radiation. We darn sure didn't understand any form of natural radiation. So we had no information on any of those things. Anything that you said as far as relationship of casual empirical data about greenhouses would be invalid. Okay. Then in 1859, an Englishman named Tyndall did experiments, and he said he proved that carbon dioxide, but he did absorption without really understanding that absorption is immediately followed by emission. Anything that has an absorption is going to also have an emission. And what happens during absorption is you transfer a little bit of energy to whatever atom or molecule is the absorbing factor. But in the process, you take a little bit of kinetic energy and increase the energy in that atom. But because of conservation energy, the emission is always a lower energy, longer wavelength photon. So you throw a photon into a mixture, and whatever absorbs in there is going to throw out something that's less. A simple example of that's like your fluorescent light. You take mercury vapor, you put it under low pressure, you put an electric arc through it, and you produce ultraviolet light, which is great if you want to kill bacteria, but what if you want to see? You put the inside of that glass tube with a phosphorus coating, the phosphorus absorbs the ultraviolet light and emits visible light. Same thing with the cathode ray tube that you use for, you know, radar and television screens. So that's what's happening. Our atmosphere is filtering out 30% of the energy coming from the sun before it ever hits the Earth.
So when the greenhouse gas theory started, though, who started that? How did it start?
Well, the official start of it, and I'm glad you brought that up, is one of the most pernicious people in the history of science, a guy named Svante Arrhenius. And he was born in Sweden in 1859. He was preceded at the time that he was recognized as a child prodigy. And at the time, Sweden only had one famous scientist, and that was Anders Angstrom, which the atomic unit of Angstrom's measurement is named after. Okay, so as he was growing up, everybody was saying, oh, you're the next Angstrom. Well, Angstrom had a son named Newt, and Svante Arrhenius hated Newt. Did everything he could to obstruct the younger Angstrom his whole life. In 1900, he became involved in the creation of the Nobel Prize, and in 1901, he was placed as a member on the Nobel Prize Committee. In 1903, he helped give himself a Nobel Prize in chemistry, and he served on the Nobel Committee until 1927. He is the one that created in 1922 the State Institute for Racial Biology in Sweden, and he worked for the last 5 years of his life to try to get racial biology listed as the Nobel Prize. So if you want to know who the father of white supremacy is, and these people that have this ideological purity about any statement that anybody made, they're digging up stuff that Reagan said to Nixon, off air in 1971.
Yeah.
And Patty Reagan's apologizing for it. You want to be morally outraged about somebody? You get outraged about the father of greenhouse gas. Okay, so he did experiments in 1895.
Yeah, back off your phone, Joe, by just a little bit, by the way.
Oh, okay. He did experiments in 1895 and said that greenhouse gas was, that carbon dioxide was a warming gas. Well, Newt Angstrom repeated his experiments and went, no, monsieur. You included water vapor in your air sample, and water vapor absorbs in 1,000 spectral lines, so you need to rerun your experiment. So he withdrew the experiment, re-released it in 1896, and Newt went, no, you've made another mistake. And so Newt challenged him on it. And back in the days when everything was horse and buggy peer review,
mm-hmm.
it took a long time for that information to make it around the planet. But I've got a copy of the monthly weather review, which was taken over by NOAA, and it's in their rescue library. Anybody can look it up. It's the June 1901 edition. Newt Angstrom on atmospheric absorption, in which the whole world recognized that carbon dioxide was not forming the planet in 1901. In 1909, Stanford professor Robert Wood actually set up greenhouses and proved that infrared light is not bothered going in or out by gas. And so what they're claiming is that you put carbon dioxide up in the atmosphere, it doesn't do anything on the incoming solar, it only picks up the outgoing heat from the Earth and bounces it back at the Earth and warms the Earth up. But the problem with that is if you go to Wien's law and you look at the absorption bands for carbon dioxide, it absorbs it at 400 degrees and at 800 degrees, and then the other absorption band, which is the outgoing long-wave radiation from Earth, is actually minus 80 degrees. And that only happens in the thermosphere, which is what gives you the apparent spike in temperature as you're going through the thermosphere in less and less atmosphere, which is absolutely impossible.
Why can't these proponents of man-made climate change admit that the Earth is also going through a cycle?
Well, that's another interesting thing. Let's go back and...
Let's hold off for a second. We're at a break coming up, Joseph. We'll come back and talk more. Joseph's website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com, and the book we're talking about that he wrote with other members of the scientific community, Slaying the Sky Dragon, Death of the Greenhouse Gas Theory. And we'll take your phone calls with him next hour on Coast to Coast AM. Well, if you want to find out where I'll be speaking for the rest of the year, just go to events at the top of the coasttocoastam.com webpage. You'll see all kinds of things. September at the Afterlife Symposium. In October, I'll be at a Chicago health show. In November, we'll be at the Earth Keepers event in Arkansas. All that information you can just track at events at coasttocoastam.com. And Tuesday, August 27th, back in Los Angeles, our luncheon series continues for the year with herbalist Sarah Chana, who will be talking about some incredible remedies. So come on out and join us for lunch. Send an email to lunchwithgeorge@gmail.com. We are back with civil engineer Joseph Olson talking right now about climate change or the lack of it. Joseph, we were talking about cycles. I've always believed this planet goes in cycles and it affects a lot of things. Why don't those who are believers in man-made climate change, and they're entitled to their views, of course, consider the cycles of Earth?
Well, let's start with one of those cycles. Back in the Proterozoic era, which was 700 million years ago, there was a thing called Popsicle Planet, and anybody can look that up online. But the Earth froze almost completely solid for over 10 million years, and that was one of the first major extinction events. So there you have a big anomaly that you'd have difficulty explaining if it was just based on solar change. Backing up for a second, we'll study what happens on the moon. The moon is the same distance from the sun, gets the same amount of energy from the sun. Anytime it's away on the far side of the sun on the Earth, it has the equal time and equal distance on the opposite side. So over a 28-month cycle, the moon gets exactly the same amount of sun as the Earth. Well, what's the maximum temperature on the moon? 240 degrees Fahrenheit.
Wow.
At the equator. What's the minimum temperature at the equator on the moon? Minus 279 degrees.
Gee, why a disparity like that?
Well, what are the factors that would change that? First of all, the moon has atmosphere, and the atmosphere slows down heat transfer. The moon has no oceans, and the oceans have an enormous ability to absorb the heat from the sun, transfer that heat by latent heat of vaporization off of the surface of the ocean, and then release that heat at the top of the clouds. And that's how clouds remain in the air. Once you have a cloud that's a water droplet, it's under the function of gravity. As water vapor, the water molecules can be active enough that they can have a certain amount of buoyancy in the air. But once they form actual globulars and droplets of water, they want to fall. And I flew a Cessna 150 through a 5,000 foot of cumulus cloud as a student pilot with only 17 hours of flight time. And let me tell you, it was horrifying. As I descended through that cloud, it kept getting darker and darker, and the raindrops kept getting larger and larger, and the wind shear was absolutely enormous. My rate of climb and airspeed gauges were bouncing back and forth, peg to peg. I knew that it was very easy to get vertigo in that situation, so I just placed myself on a heading and looked at the turn ball indicator, and that was the only two instruments I had in the whole plane that were not affected by the massive updrafts that were coming through the plane. I would get like 15, 20 seconds of thundering rain on the top of the plane, and then I'd get the same thundering rain for the same period of time on the bottom of the plane. You had vertical shear going up and down inside that cloud. What was happening is the water vapor was coming down. As I exited the bottom of the cloud, I could look up and actually see the drops coming down, swinging in the air, and then turning and going right back up through the cloud. And that's what's going on. And you don't feel it when you're in a 200,000-pound air jetliner and you're flying 400 miles an hour. You don't feel those things. But let me tell you, when you're in a 1,500-pound Cessna with 100 horsepower, and the propeller is spinning absolutely insane because of the wind shear going up and down on it, and you put in carb heat so that you don't freeze your carburetor, and you throttle back, and all you do is just a wing and a prayer. You keep hitting more and more denser and thicker clouds as you're coming down. And I don't know about you, but the last time that I was in a thunderstorm, it was pretty much of a cooling event.
It is a cooling event. I was just in one in southern Florida. It was torrential rains.
Yeah, the average thunderstorm is a 20-mile diameter. It has 16,500 tons of water. It blocks out sunlight, and then when it drops that, it either drops it as cooling rain or freezing hail, sleet, and snow. But because water absorbs in 50,000 spectral lines, the warmest had to say it's a warming gas, because otherwise they couldn't claim that. But I'm telling you, when was the last time a cloud got between you and the sun and you felt warmer?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you this though, Joseph.
Yes.
At what point do we take? And let's assume the man-made climate change believers are wrong, and that those who believe we're in Earth cycles or the Earth is changing on its own are correct. What's really happening? I mean, are the shorelines going to increase? Are the ice caps going to melt, regardless of the cause?
Well, you have another guest, Graham Hancock, who's been on it.
Sure, about many times.
Oh, yeah, I've read four of his books. He's absolutely meticulous. And he documented that at the start of the Holocene, there was up to 3 mile thick ice caps on the northern hemisphere, and that all of that melted in less than 2,000 years. Well, what could have caused that melting? Well, let's get back to the other factor that keeps the Earth from getting to the same cold temperature that the moon gets. And that is, we have two heat sources. One is the sun, which is moderated by the atmosphere and the oceans to keep us from getting as hot as the moon. And the other is the furnace that's underneath our feet. The Earth has 259 billion cubic miles of, quote, solid Earth. Out of that, about 3 parts per million is uranium. You do the math, it ends up being 800,000 cubic miles of uranium. We also have 1.2 million miles of thorium, and all of those are doing radioactive decay. And so if you look it up on Wikipedia, it's theoretically possible for 1 kilogram of uranium-235 to produce as much energy as 1,500 tons of coal.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Pretty dramatic.
Yeah. And then in the 1940s, there was a physics professor at Harvard, Percy Bridgman, who actually ended up getting a Nobel Prize for physics, who was doing specific heat calculations under extreme temperatures and extreme pressures, a really dangerous thing to be doing. And he tested, you know, a whole bunch of materials. Specific heat is sort of like specific gravity, you know, where you take air and you say normal air is 1.0, and then we're going to measure everything based on that and look at helium is 0.16, and and so it's a metric that you use just so that you get some kind of idea what the ratios of things are. And they do a similar thing with water, where they take standard water and then they'll come in with seawater being, you know, 1.05, and so basically it's a method of determining the heat capacity of various substances. Well, what he found out is that under 50,000 psi of pressure, every element on the metallic series can go under fission. Well, if you look at the periodic table, about half of the elements on the periodic table are metallic. And if you calculate out what the pressure is at 125 pounds per cubic foot for dirt, you go 40 miles deep, and you have enough pressure for any metallic substance to be fissioned just by natural. So we have this enormous furnace underneath our feet, and every bit of the energy that's coming out of the Earth is going through the biosphere. So as the energy that's coming from the sun can be reflected by clouds or filtered out by absorption and lower energy emissions in the atmosphere, 100% of what's coming out of the ground is going through the biosphere, and that's what sets your baseline temperature for the Earth so that we don't drop. The other factor is that the moon has a 14-day night-day rotation cycle in Earth days, and the Earth has only a 24-hour. So that's where you end up with that little anomaly.
And did this whole thing of climate change take off with Al Gore? Is that, if I recall, that's kind of where it all started in terms of publicity.
Actually, it started with the Club of Rome.
In terms of widespread publicity.
He just jumped on as a front man. He has absolutely no science training. He couldn't explain anything to you. He was just a well-known political figure, so he was adopted as their poster boy.
Okay.
But what happened during the Reagan administration, the average funding for climatology was $20 million a year. When George Bush got president, he ramped it up dramatically, and by 1992, the U.S. government was funding $1 billion a year in carbon endangerment findings.
Jeez.
And if all you fund is findings for danger, danger is all you're going to find.
That's all you're going to find. They want to keep
that
flowing.
That's all you're going to find. Yeah, yeah. In the Slick Willie presidency, he ramped that up to $2 billion a year. So we've squandered $100 billion a year funding every little hairball scheme that they come up. You know, it's killing the polar bears, it's causing prostitution, it's increasing fleas, it's ocean acidification, which I hope we'll get to in a minute. But, you know, this whole matrix of things that they dreamed up that evil carbon dioxide can do, because you can qualify for a $1 or $2 million grant for your university if you can come up with any excuse why carbon dioxide is the most evil thing on the planet.
And we're no better off than we were when they started all this.
No, we could have given fresh water to every human being on the planet.
We could have built housing for homeless. We could have done everything.
We could have developed free energy. We could have done so many things with $100 billion that we've squandered in this ridiculous fake debate. And that's why I have a real issue with the people that claim to be skeptics. And I don't come by this as just cavalier and, you know, uppity about it. I actually went to the debates with Richard Lindzen and Gary North at the Petroleum Club in Houston, and then later that night at Rice University. I attended two events with Larry Bell, who you've had on your program before, Climate of Corruption author. He's a professor at University of Houston. He invited Fred Singer down for two-hour presentations. I attended the Heartland ICC9 convention in Las Vegas, a three-day-long convention with over 600 people there. And back to serendipity, I went there and I was going around talking to everybody about why do you completely neglect the variability of volcanism in the center of the planet as being a climate force. And everybody's going, oh, no, we've already dismissed that. It's constant and it's trivial. And it's like, it's not constant and it's not trivial. And I bumped into a guy named Arthur Vitero, who is a geography professor at University of Maryland. And he had a list of 1 million data points based on 30 years of NOAA satellite, which is the most accurate temperature records we've got, and USGS seismic that determined what the PDO, the Pacific Dicleidal Oscillation, is. That's the El Niño and La Niña. And that cycle is directly correlated with the earthquake cycles. And so he wrote, after I met him and he showed me his data, I said, you need to write this up, because he went there looking for confirmation from any skeptic that this was correct. And I was the only one he found that was there. He had a few people and went, well, yeah, your data looks pretty compelling. But I was the only one that said, Arthur, you've got to write a paper on that. Well, he wrote a paper, submitted it to the American Meteorological Association. He said, I won't have any problem getting it published there. I've been a 30-year member, and they've published other works of mine there. And I was like, oh, great. He waited 9 months before he finally got a rejection, not a single word from him. He'd ask him, you know, what's going on there? Oh, it's still in review. 9 months, they sent him back and said, it violates the greenhouse gas hypothesis, so we're not going to publish it. And we struggled for a year to finally find another publisher that would publish it. And since then, he's written four more papers. All of those are at Principia Scientific International. So you can go to that site and review the work by Arthur Vituro and verify his factors on variability and temperature. And he studied the Atlantic Ocean, and then he studied the Indian Ocean and the Arctic Ocean. Studied the seismic record and the temperature records of all four of the major oceans. There's a major rift line, and there again, I had mentioned Fourier and Tyndall. There's a great site by an Australian named Timothy Casey called Geologist-1011, and he has the original Fourier translation from French, and he has the original published Tyndall experiments at his website, but he also has a article called Volcanic CO2. And there's over 100,000 miles of rift lines around the ocean. That's your Pacific Rim, and it's pretty obvious to anybody that's been studying current events for the last few years that earthquakes are not constant, volcanoes are not constant, and so you have a variable cycle right there that we're not plugging into the equation. And those are just expressions, artifacts of what's really going on, and that's the heat change that's going on.
Are we doomed, Joseph, regardless of what's going on?
No. We're not doomed. The planet has been able to buffer these forces for the last,
for 4.5 billion years.
Yeah. So, we're not adding a little bit of carbon dioxide, and I calculated it out. You take the 28 gigatons a year that they say we're putting in the atmosphere, convert that to graphite, you get 1 cubic mile of graphite. Well, what do we do with that carbon? We combine it with oxygen that's already in the air, and that forms CO2. So that means you take roughly 2 cubic miles of oxygen, combine it with 1 cubic mile of carbon, and that gives you 3 cubic miles of gas that determines the temperature of 310 million cubic miles of ocean, and it also determines the temperature of 259 billion cubic miles of Earth? I really don't think so.
Now, when you're with someone who believes in man-made climate change, not pollution, but man-made climate change, do you guys scream at each other?
No, actually, they end the debate really quickly because they realize that if you know what you're talking about, you can't possibly believe what they're talking about. So let's get back to cycles. We've gotten as far as the Holocene with Graham Hancock.
All right, we're coming up on a break, and then I definitely want to ask you why you don't think we may have landed on the moon.
Okay,
we'll get into that too, but we're gonna hit a break.
And then we'll take callers, and they'll be great. Thank you.
They will. And you wanted to say something about the ocean, so we'll do that next hour too. Yeah, we'll be back in a moment. Joseph Olson with us as we're talking about climate change. He does not believe it's man-made climate change. Whatever you believe, you're entitled to it. Get ready to make the call, and we'll get you on the program here. His book is called "Slaying the Sky Dragon: Death of the Greenhouse Gas Theory," and pretty convincing. Pretty convincing. I mean, I've always believed the planet is going through cycles anyway. We'll be back with more in a moment.